for those of you who have been participating in these calls for a little while, probably remember Deborah did a call for us, I guess it was over a year ago now, on some master trust issues, and we're happy to have her back. Today she's going to talk about independent living. Deborah is with Florida Legal Services up in Jacksonville. She does impact lobbying and litigation throughout the state, and she is by far, she was instrumental in the independent living, the massive changes to independent living that were passed, not this year, but the year before, and she's definitely the state expert on independent living. So I'm going to hand it over to her at this point. I would remind everyone that we did just send out the materials probably about an hour ago. If you did not receive them and you're on the call right now, if you shoot me an email, I'm in Citrix, I'll be happy to forward it to you. It may be that your supervisor and attorney is stuck in court or something and you haven't been able to get them. So, and Deborah will take questions at the end, so if you could just jot down your questions again, because we're recording this, we're asking everyone to keep the questions till the end, and she'll break at about 12:50 to make sure we have time for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mary Kay. Good afternoon, everybody. I appreciate your attending this call, and I hope I can do it justice. I guess in a way it's kind of easy to be an expert in an area that's brand new. And independent living, although it's been around for a few years now, it still is relatively new, and there's not a whole lot of case law. Actually, there's no case law interpreting its provisions yet, which makes analysis of the statutes and the rules pretty important. And I think it provides a lot of opportunity and room for advocacy. I know that you're going to have a legislative update, but I wanted to go over to begin with Senate Bill 2114. This bill has been enrolled. It has not yet been acted on. I don't think it's even been sent to the governor yet, but there's no expectation that this bill will be vetoed because the department was on board with it, as was ACCA. So I wanted to go through that because it specifically addresses independent living. One of the first things that it does is it adds a new category of youth who will be eligible to participate in the post-18 independent living programs. So now we have DCF serving youth who were in foster care when they turned 18. In addition, it has now been funded. This change was attempted to go through in 06, but because there was no appropriation for it and the change was contingent on the appropriation, it failed. But now the appropriation is in the bill. So we also have youth who were adopted from foster care or who were placed with a court-appointed guardian with these three conditions. The child has to have been at least 16 years of age when either adopted or placed with a court-approved guardian. The child must have spent a minimum of 6 months in foster care, and that 6 months must have occurred within the 12 months immediately preceding the adoption or the placement. The point of this is to encourage permanent placement for youth who are almost ready to age out, because we realize that when kids have spent time in foster care and they're that old, by the time they're 16, in all likelihood, they're going to need additional help from the state when they turn 18, even if they move into a permanent placement. Then there's another particular change to Road to Independence eligibility. That's the program that provides the maximum amount of benefits for youth who are attending school full-time. In the past, the statute was only addressing youth who had aged out of the system. So all of the independent living programs, aftercare services, transitional services, and Road to Independence, were only available for kids who had already become adults. Now, if you have a foster child who has already earned a standard high school diploma, a special diploma, or a special certificate of high school completion before turning 18, that youth is able to participate in the Road to Independence program even before turning 18. So for those few children who are actually on track and or early with their education, if they're ready to go on to college or to a qualifying vocational program, they are able to get additional help to do that. Another very important thing that changed is concerning a youth's driver's license. We all know that in Florida, except perhaps in a few of our major cities, it is absolutely crucial that everybody be able to drive, because public transportation just doesn't do the trick in getting people around, especially if they're both going to school and trying to work at the same time. And it's very difficult for kids to get a driver's license. Currently, the law at Section 322.09 in Florida statutes allows either a foster parent or an authorized representative of a group home to sign a driver's license application for a foster child. And at the same time, they will not be responsible for any negligence or willful misconduct of the foster child while operating a car. However, there are still very few group home representatives or foster parents who are willing to do this, even though they're absolved of liability. So this bill adds in caseworkers at the agency where the state has placed the minor. Those caseworkers are also able to sign the youth's driver's license application. However, their protection from liability is based on the driver's license being a part of a court-approved transition plan. So clearly, if you are a guardian for a child who is 16 or over and that child needs to learn how to drive, then you need to advocate with the caseworker that the caseworker put into the transition plan this activity and that the court approve the transition plan, and then ensure that the caseworker actually signs that driver's license application. The caseworker has to notify the foster parent or other responsible party of the caseworker's intent to sign the application. I don't think that it requires the foster parent, well, it doesn't require the foster parent to allow the child to drive his or her car. It just means that the child can apply for a driver's license or a permit, and then hopefully the child will be able to access driver's license education at school. Driver's licenses are part of what we call normalcy or age-appropriate activities for foster children. It's been very difficult, again, to get foster parents to be willing to allow children to engage in these age-appropriate activities or normalcy activities, even though the administrative code made it very clear that age-appropriate activities are to be engaged in by foster children, and that rule was approved last year. So now the statute at 409.1451.3A3, and these sites are all in your material, so you don't have to write any of it down, that, again, provided that whatever the activity is in a written plan that's been developed and signed by the foster parent or caregiver and the child and the case manager, then the foster parent shall not be held responsible for or have their license at risk when the child participates in that age-appropriate activity. So that seems to have been the primary concern of foster parents and group home staff in allowing foster kids to engage in the normal things that kids their own age engage in, being worried that, well, you say that we're supposed to do this, but we're worried that if something happens and the kid gets hurt while doing something, we're going to have our foster licenses at risk. And now this statute says no. As long as there's a written plan that's been developed and signed by the necessary people, then you're allowing that child to go out and do things like going to the movies with friends or going to a sleepover or going on school field trips. You'll be allowed to allow the child to do those things, and your licensing will not be at risk. Now, the issue that I have with this particular bill is, which children does it cover? While I'd like to say it covers all kids, so that a 10-year-old might be able to go off for a sleepover without special court permission or special departmental permission, I believe that this statute is only going to apply to kids in foster care who have reached the age of 13. And the reason that I think this is because this age-appropriate activity language is in Chapter 40 in Section 409.1451, and within the body of that statute, it requires the department to provide a system of services for, quote, older foster children, end quote, and it specifically states that the department shall serve children who have reached 13 years of age but who are not yet 18 years of age. So I think that it's probably limited to 13-year-olds and above, but I would certainly make the argument that the rules permit normalcy for all children, and I guess if you need a court order saying that the children should be able to engage in these activities, by all means, seek those court orders. Back to kids who have aged out, one of the things that's very important is continued access to health care. Now, currently, a former foster youth who is eligible to receive any of the services under 409.1451 sub 5, in other words, aftercare, transitional support, or road to independence, is able to receive Medicaid up to the age of 20. This bill increases the age up to the age to the age of 21. So we now have kids that are able to continue to get health care, mental health care paid for by Medicaid until they are 21 years old, beginning July 1st of this year. So I am not certain if that means that even if you already turned 18 before July 1st of this year, you're still able to keep going until you're 21. I'm not sure if you've already turned 20 before July 1st and you are cut off. Like, let's say you have a youth who turns 20 years old on June 30th of this year. I'm not sure if they come back in to become eligible or not. And I think that that is going to require some advocacy as well. And hopefully Florida Legal Services and Florida's Children First will work on that as well to try to get the department to issue some clarifying rules or statements of policy in regard to this. The other thing that I want to point out is that this statute only says that you have to be eligible to receive services. It does not say that you have to be receiving those services. Any youth who ages out of foster care, even if they were only in foster care for one day, is eligible to receive aftercare support. So I would interpret this bill as allowing every youth who's aged out to receive Medicaid now through the age of 21, well, beginning July the 1st. Back to the youth who are under 21, another thing that's been very difficult for them is having access to bank accounts. The banks have typically required kids to have somebody co-sign with them on their bank accounts. A few credit unions will allow some small little accounts to be held without co-signatures, I believe, but for most of the kids in foster care, this has been a big problem. We are trying to teach them independent living skills. They're being taught about proper banking, but it's very difficult, especially for a kid, to learn these things in the abstract. It's much easier to learn how to do banking and how to write checks and save money when you actually have those kinds of bank accounts. So last year, we had a similar situation where the legislature removed the disabilities of non-age. That time it was for the specific purpose of allowing youth who had reached the age of 17 to be able to execute all the necessary documents in order to be able to move into their own housing on the day they turned 18 instead of having to wait until that 18th birthday to begin to complete the application process. So building on that, this part of the bill adds a section to Chapter 743, and it's 743.044, removing the disabilities of non-age for banking purposes. So the requirements are that the youth has to be at least 16 years of age, the youth has to have been adjudicated dependent, the youth must reside in an out-of-home placement, The youth must have completed a financial literacy course, and the youth must receive a court order removing the disability of non-age for banking purposes. And hopefully the Rules Committee will go ahead and prepare a uniform court order for that. The financial services that this applies to is called depository financial services, and the bill itself indicates that those are checking and savings accounts. So those are the types of accounts that the youth are eligible to get after July 1st of this year, but they are going to need that court order. That is a point of advocacy for guardians. I know that the court order for the 17-year-olds, at least in some areas, is not routinely done. In Jacksonville, for example, if the CBC decides with the youth that the youth is going to move in with a family member, they will not get that court order. So then what happens is, because they deem it unnecessary, so what happens is at the last minute, if that proposed placement falls apart, then the youth is left holding the bag on that. So I think it's important that guardians push to make sure that that court order is entered, whether the youth needs it or not, at the age of 17, so the youth has that order and can then use it as he or she feels appropriate. And I think the same thing is going to be true with this banking order. You may as well just go ahead and get it done at the first judicial review after the child turns 16, so that when the child is ready to have a bank account, then the order is already done and the child can go off and secure his or her own bank account. So I don't think that those are things that people should wait on and say, well, if the child demonstrates the need for this order, we'll go get it. I think that that's something that should just be done automatically. So those are the changes to the independent living statute and normalcy statutes for foster kids and former foster kids. I next wanted to sort of go backwards in time and in the time of a child's age in foster care and talk about older foster youth. And I wanted to begin talking specifically about subsidized independent living. Again, this is a program that has actually been in the statutes for a long time. It used to be essentially extended foster care. And then a number of years ago, it was changed by the legislature to allow a youth who was at least 16 years old and who demonstrated the ability to live with some independence to essentially do a trial independent living period, where they were still, the child is still in foster care, and therefore the child still is eligible for post-18 independent living services and the public school tuition and fee exemptions, but the child gets to go out and live on his or her own. The child is not completely independent because the child is still in foster care, and the rules, in fact, specifically require a great deal of oversight by the caseworkers in the first 3 months of this subsidized independent living program. That's one of the reasons that many caseworkers frown on it. I've seen many, many caseworkers who will just routinely reject kids' applications for subsidized independent living. And unfortunately, there is no administrative remedy for this program the way there is in 409.1451 for the post-18 programs. However, because there is no other remedy, I believe that you, on the child's behalf, can raise the issues of subsidized independent living with the juvenile court. The CBCs, pursuant to the rule, are specifically given the right to seek prior court approval if they wish, and I think that that strengthens the jurisdiction of the court, the authority of the court, to intervene in subsidized independent living issues, since it says that the CBCs can take the approval to the court first. I think that then the youth has the right to access that same provision to seek court placement into independent living, subsidized independent living. Additionally, the Senate Bill 2114 that I was speaking of a few moments ago now requires that a formal subsidized independent living evaluation be done for all eligible youth who have reached the age of 16. The statute doesn't say what eligible, quote-unquote, youth is. There's no definition of that. I would advocate that the eligibility is based upon the statutory criteria only. When you look in your program manual that you have on independent living programs, because I did review some of that before today's call, it does delineate the difference between the statutory requirements and the regulatory requirements, although it doesn't call the regulatory requirements that, but it delineates them by saying that these are requirements that can be waived. In terms of having the actual formal evaluation done that's now going to be required by statute, I would argue that that eligibility is the statutory criteria. And that statutory criteria is that the youth have to be 16, have to have been adjudicated dependent, have to have been in licensed out-of-home care for at least 6 months, and to be able to demonstrate independent living skills as determined by the department using established procedures and assessments. Well, frankly, I think that this mandatory formal evaluation is the procedure and assessment at this point. So that is the argument that I would make to at least get the evaluation done. With the regulatory requirements, as I said, and as your manual indicates, they can be waived by the district administrator or by the CEO or his or her delegate at the agency. And there is ample opportunity to waive many of those requirements for youth. One of the things that is very important to think about when thinking about subsidized independent living is remembering that that is still considered foster care. Unfortunately, we are still to this day seeing around the state some agencies that will directly place a child with a non-relative adult, not in a guardianship, and the guardianships have been available under the statute since last year, but they've been being placed directly. And when there is a direct placement of a child, even when that placement is in the child's best interest and is a good thing, and even when it's what the kid wants, the direct placement takes the kid out of foster care. And we're still seeing agencies that are doing these direct placements for kids who are 17 and a half years old. And some of these kids have been in foster care for a large part of their life. And that is just criminal to do to these kids. When you can just as easily, or almost just as easily, place the child with that same adult, but calling it subsidized independent living. Now, sometimes you'll have a kid who might have had some trouble with the law a few months ago, or you might have a kid who ran away a while ago or just got kicked out of a foster home. You can have those requirements waived if this placement is appropriate for the youth. But you want to be very careful about cutting kids off from the post-18 independent living programs as well as cutting them off from the tuition and fee exemptions. So that it's very important to look at subsidized independent living. The other reason that I pushed that is because it's not very likely that most kids can take advantage of this program unless they're going to go live with an older family member or a non-relative adult. And the reason for that is because landlords don't rent to kids. That's pretty much the end of the discussion. There are some programs around the state that have been and are in the process of being constructed for this purpose, but with those programs, it's going to be a little bit less than what the statute provides for totally or almost totally independent living, but that's okay. The more of these placements where we can move kids out to being on their own and experiencing for themselves what it's like to have to pay rent, for example, on time, and keeping bank accounts and being able to get themselves up in the morning to go to school while having oversight of caseworkers is a good idea. But at the same time, the primary use of this program today is to avoid direct placement. placements that would take the kids out of post-18 services and the tuition and fee exemptions. One of the regulatory requirements that I wanted to specifically talk about is the requirement that the youth attend school full-time. That is not in the statute. The statute doesn't say that in order for a 16-year-old foster child to go into subsidized independent living, they have to go to school. It just says there has to be a written plan concerning their education. So one of the areas, I mean, I think that that area is important in all respects, that you might have a child who is perfectly able to go into subsidized independent living, but who only goes to school part-time, and perhaps it's so that they can go to school and that they can work a number of hours to enable them to go into subsidized independent living at the same time. And I think that if you have a responsible child, youth, that this is an area of advocacy. But I wanted to point out that the waiver of some of these requirements can be especially important for youth with disabilities. The rule in the Florida Administrative Code governing subsidized independent living is 65C-28.009. And that rule specifically recognizes the application of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it requires the department to provide reasonable accommodations so that disabled youth can participate in the subsidized independent living program. And that actually is true of all of the independent living programs, but I want to talk about it specifically in relation to this one. However, the rule doesn't provide any further guidance. It doesn't say what types of reasonable accommodations the agency must provide. So as an advocate for a disabled youth who wanted to go into this program who said, I'm afraid to go to school full time, then I would argue that if in fact the child has a disability that makes it more difficult for that child to attend school full time, that that's one of those areas where a waiver should be granted. Now, you might have a disability, a learning disability, but you might also have a physical disability that makes it much more difficult for the child to get around to where and where the child gets tired more easily and it just is not able to put in a full day at school, especially if that youth also has to work a little bit in order to participate in this program and have the money to pay for their living arrangements. The statute, as I mentioned before, does not provide an administrative remedy to challenge any decisions that the department makes. However, whenever you've got a program that you're eligible for constitutionally, when the government says yes or no to you, you have to have an ability to challenge that decision. I know why the department did not want to put that in the statute is they don't want children challenging them specifically, but I think that on behalf of the child as the guardian, you are able to raise these issues in court. Now, depending upon what the waiver issue is, I think that you need to consider whether you're going to just file a motion in the dependency court, which of course is easy to do because that court is already there. You don't have to file a new action or anything else. But I think if you're raising a specific ADA claim, you might want to think about filing an action in circuit civil court rather than going into dependency court. And those decisions would have to be made on a case-by-case basis. But do keep in mind that just because there is a dependency action ongoing, that does not preclude you from filing something else on behalf of the child in another court. Next, I wanted to talk about minor parents in foster care, and a part of the reason that I want to talk about it is because there is a special group home in Jacksonville for parenting dependent teens, and it's called Promise House. And Promise House is a wonderful facility, and it takes girls. It's for mothers, not fathers. Although the statute applies equally to males and females alike, I have never personally run into a teenage father who has custody of his child. I have, however, seen a number of young ladies who are dependent who have babies. And Promise House is for young women, dependent women, who have custody of their children, either because the dependency court adjudicated the baby dependent but placed the baby either into with the agency who then placed the child at Promise House, or the court adjudicated the child dependent but still placed the child back with the mom, or in some instances these children are not necessarily dependent themselves. But in any event, I wanted to talk about this because it still seems as though in many parts of the state, the agency and the protective investigators are still wanting to immediately file dependency petitions as to infants who are born to young women in foster care or who are coming into foster care solely because the mom is a dependent child. And Rule 65C-28.010 specifically says that no, you are not to do that. There should only be a dependency petition filed as to the baby if that baby's safety will be at substantial risk, or if there's no foster, well, actually, that's when you file the dependency petition, is only if the younger child's safety will be at substantial risk. The parent and child are to be placed together even if the child is the baby is declared dependent. They are to be placed together unless the placement itself would place the baby at risk, or if there's no foster home or group home available to house both of them. If you don't have housing that can house both the mom and baby in your community, one thing that you can do is to advocate with the agency to see about creating such housing and look at various models around the state, because we do have a number of these families and it's important that we serve them and that we serve them well, and to make sure that babies are only adjudicated dependent when that is necessary to do. Unfortunately, the minor parents' lawyers, court-appointed lawyers, often don't seem to know about this rule, and there still is a lot of ennui, I guess, about this, where the court-appointed lawyers just still advise their clients to go ahead and agree to the dependency. If you think that the baby needs some protection, if you believe that the minor parent needs to be required to do certain tasks, remember that voluntary protective services are always available, and you can use those to place controls on the minor parent's behavior. When thinking all of this through, when either the minor parent first comes into foster care or the young lady in foster care gives birth to a baby, think through to the end result. If you're in some sort of a group home together, or both the mother and child are in a foster home together, and both of them are dependent, when the mother turns 18, what's going to happen to the baby? I just had a young lady who turned 18 this week, and it was a very touch-and-go situation. She was from Polk County. She and her baby were both dependent. There was no need for the dependency, but her court-appointed lawyer just told her to agree to the dependency. Until a week before her 18th birthday, nobody knew what was going to happen. The mom could not stay in this group home because the group home rates are very expensive. And if she had the money, she could have stayed there because, you know, the statute allows a youth aging out of foster care to stay in their foster home, but the youth is responsible for paying for the board rate or negotiate with the foster home. And in this instance, the foster home says, this is our board rate and you have to pay it, and there's no way, it's many thousands of dollars a month, and there's just no way that any of these young ladies can stay there after they turn 18. And we were really worried that the baby was going to be shipped back into down to Polk County for foster care, and that would have been terrible. So I pushed a little bit. I had a very difficult time representing her because I wasn't court-appointed and because it was so far geographically far away from me. But I was able to talk with the folks at the guardian ad litem office in Polk County, and I think that that was provided some fire to get things going, because finally the court agreed that the child could go into the custody of the mom under protective supervision. So that was very touch and go. But remember that. Think about what's going to happen to that baby when the mom turns 18 before automatically thinking that a dependency petition is the way to go. If the dependent parent is in a foster home and the baby is not dependent, nonetheless, the department provides an enhanced board rate to the foster home, and that enhanced board rate is to include the younger child's needs. Another thing that I've seen in representing young parenting women is that oftentimes the foster parent will say to the parent, I don't get any money for your baby, so you have to buy all the baby food, all the diapers, all the necessities for your child. This simply isn't true. And I think that it's important to advocate here, because if the young parent is having to work a lot of hours in order to provide necessities for the baby, and the board rate's already been enhanced for that purpose, that young lady may end up doing poorly in school. And I have seen that happen before. And you have to ask these girls, because they don't just come out with this information for you. So when I finally learned it, I was able to get the caseworker to lean on the foster parent and you know, work it out, that the foster parent finally acknowledged that, I'm supposed to be providing diapers and food for your baby. Unfortunately, by that time, my client was almost 18, and she had essentially quit going to school for a long time, and the foster parent also never reported that, so she ended up dropping out of school. But I am happy to say she's back in school now in a GED program, so that's really good. There is a disincentive for any minor dependent parent to participate in subsidized independent living, because in that instance, the minor's child's needs are not included in the subsidized independent living payment to her. So young ladies just need to keep that in mind, and they've got to weigh the pros and cons of moving out of a foster home or a group home with their baby into subsidized independent living, because then they are going to be responsible for working better for their children, to working more hours to provide for their children. And that leads me into just a very short, like, little blip or break in the substantive discussion, just to say how important it is to look at the Florida Administrative Code. We just went through this rule in the code on minor parents in foster care. We went through partially the rule on subsidized independent living, and we've taken a look at a few other rules that are in the Florida Administrative Code, including those on normalcy. Many people never think to look at the Florida Administrative Code. And it is true that in the past, the rules were not very explicit anyway, and there wasn't much of a reason to look at the code. But after the federal audit by Health and Human Services a number of years ago, part of the department's improvement plan was to adopt better rules. And the department in the past 2 years has been working on adopting much more extensive rules. And you can see that from the examples that we've already gone through. The rules are important because you often are able to get from them the vision of the department's program office as to how the law is to be implemented. Now, this vision is often not explicated completely in the statutes, but if it's in the rule, then that should guide how casework is carried out. Sometimes it isn't. So it's important that not only you know the rules, but that the court know the rules as well. When you're wanting a caseworker to do more for the child than the caseworker is willing to do. However, there may be times that the rule goes beyond the statute. It either conflicts with the statute or the rule exceeds its statutory authority, and you believe that that is detrimental to the child. Then you can argue that that rule is illegal and cannot be applied in that situation. If you believe that that rule needs to be challenged so that the challenge goes to all foster kids and not just your particular client, you do that challenge in a formal DOA administrative proceeding. I'm sure that that's outside the realm of, or generally outside the realm of your charge. And if you're not able to do that but believe it needs to be done, Florida Legal Services has an administrative branch that does administrative rule challenges. Then I want to sort of quickly, because time is getting short, talk about special casework requirements for a foster child who reaches the age of 17. And the outline is pretty explicit on this, so I'll try to just hit the highlights so that I can leave room for questions. There are two things that have to happen. One happens administratively and the other happens in court. That those things are triggered by the youth's 17th birthday. Within a month of that 17th birthday, the agency is required to conduct a new and a specialized assessment of the youth's skills and ability to live independently. And that's further delineated in the administrative code. Based on the results of that assessment, and that assessment can include psychological assessments, medical assessments, interviews with people that are close to the child, and that would include the guardians, I should hope, teachers, there should be educational assessments as well. Based on the assessment results, not only are age-appropriate services and training to be provided, but expedited services and training are to be provided. You can see why we now have 1 year to do what needs to be done to have this child ready to age out of the system. The expedition of services and a full and complete assessment are issues that the guardian's office is uniquely situated to push for these children. The department is supposed to put the results of the assessment in an updated life skills plan, and that's to include information from the staffings. It's to include an enumeration of the services provided, and it's also to include the youth's progress to date. That information then turns around and gets put into the judicial review social study report for each subsequent JR. Again, you can ensure that that information is included in the JRSSR. You also want to ensure that the child participates in the development of all of this. The statute specifically requires that the child sign on to it, and then I've given you a citation to Chapter 39 that I believe requires the youth to participate in the development of that as well. Common sense also tells you that. Then within 3 months of the youth's 17th birthday, the court should conduct a special judicial review. Even if it's outside of the six-month rotation, it doesn't matter. Within 3 months, there has to be a JR. And at that point, you need to make sure that the agency has done what it's supposed to do. That's why the agency has to do their thing within 1 month, so that when you get into the court review for the 17th birthday, the agency's work is already done and recorded, and the court is able to review that. Now, children have a right to attend their judicial review hearings. Many of them don't. Many of them don't because some judges don't like it. In other areas, the caseworkers don't like it because they don't want to have to go transport the child. For this judicial review, it is crucial that the child is present. Try to have the court schedule these so that the child's not having to miss school to attend, and also ensure that the agency provides transportation for the child to court. For many of us, our high schools let out at 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so it should still be possible to have a judicial review for these 17-year-olds. That is at a time when the court will still be in session, but where the child doesn't have to miss school, or at least have it so that they miss as few classes as possible that day. It's so important that this be done, and the Florida legislature believes it's so important that this be done, that the statute on this judicial review specifically includes in it the court having the authority to issue an order to show cause directed at the agency if the agency hasn't done what it's supposed to do. So if you get to that judicial review and the agency has done a very summary assessment rather than an in-depth assessment, if they haven't done necessary evaluations of the child, if their services are cookie cutter and you know that your child needs particularized services, anything that needs to happen has to happen now So you should be advocating with the court to issue that order to show cause directed at the agency. Now, the court always has contempt authority, but it's, to me, it's telling that the legislature specifically put that into this section under the 17-year-old judicial review, and that's found at 39.701 subsection 6C. So please be an advocate there as well and make sure that that's done, because the more work that can be done to help this child learn what they need to learn in order to make it on their own, the more stable they're going to be when they turn 18. They need to learn the things, they need to learn what it takes to pay your rent on time, to pay your utilities. They need to learn that there are rules about living in apartments, and that they need to know that they're going to get evicted from the apartments if they go crazy, like so many of them do, and they have parties. They're not necessarily bad parties, but they can be very loud, noisy parties late at night, and they end up, so many kids end up getting kicked out of their apartments after they turn 18. So all of these services are absolutely crucial. You also need to make sure that all of the different things that the agency has to ensure the child has notice of at that 17-year judicial review, that the agency has actually done it. And that includes they have to have begun the process for knowing how they're going to continue getting Medicaid after they turn 18. It doesn't just automatically happen. There is a process that the youth and the caseworker has to go through. There are processes that have to happen. And frequently, the agencies, the independent living coordinators, are not yet focusing on where is the child going to live. And that is supposed to be figured out at that 17-year judicial review as well. And I think it's very important that all of that work at least begin at that 17th year. And if it hasn't begun, then that's where your advocacy can come into play for these kids, and your advocacy is very important. And with that, I'm ready to take questions.